points of discussion?
Well, okay. I don't think there is one because this wasn't planned for this afternoon. They were planned to have the individual workshops. So as I understand it from Joe at lunch, the idea was that we would continue what we were doing this morning. The problem is that we're two different groups this morning and now we're one different group, so we may not know what each other has actually accomplished. This morning we talked about how the movement affected us and how we got into it and how it worked in our lives after we left and went home and did that sort of thing. I don't know what the other group talked about, so I'm not sure. Somebody want to share that?
We were on the verge of getting to that.
We talked about our experiences in Macon and America.
Oh, okay.
Memorable experiences, that kind of
thing. Okay.
Dangerous experiences.
Okay. Iris and I actually were the only people in our group who were in America, so we didn't talk too much about Americas at that point.
Do we know how to operate this thing?
It supposedly is on. Or not.
Usually there's a light that goes on.
Well, there's a light, but I can't tell if it's on or not. Can you see it? So we didn't get much of a discussion about Americas because Molly was here. And Midge and Barbara were here, so most of the people in Americas were in Group One.
And they did discuss it.
Yeah,
they did a good.
Good. And as I say, Iris and I were the only two in Group Two that had ended up in Americas who are here. There were others from Savannah who came later, but we were the only two here. So, and we've talked about that by email many times along the way, because I'm person that's writing the America story, which is why I've asked most of you who've been in touch whether you were in Americas, and Beth, I think you're the only one who said no so far.
No, I was not.
You did not go, so I think I've been trying to narrow that down so we're sure that we include everybody when we mention this. So maybe we should go on with what you guys were doing. Because we didn't really get that much into what happened afterwards either. You know, you said you talked about your experiences in the movement.
And also, some of us talked about or mentioned how our families and friends thought it was going to the South.
Yeah.
Because that's a whole different thing, how your family...
It was. Most of them thought we were crazy, I think. But that's a fairly common thing. I had, and I'll say this now just so we'll catch up on this. I was kind of unique in that I was born and raised and grew up in Macomb, Mississippi. And so I was not, they didn't know how to categorize me. I wasn't a northern agitator. I was a homegrown, I was a traitor rather than just an outside agitator. Because I should have known better.
And they couldn't get rid of me.
You guys were basically pictured as, well, they just didn't know any better. They're these naive college kids from the north. And I was supposed to, I was in Macomb during the Freedom Summer of 64. I was supposed to know better than this. And that's why Jose always called me his white boy from Mississippi, because, you know, he had nicknames for everyone. But that was his nickname for me, because in some sense he saw me as an asset of being able to say, here's a southern white person who is here in the movement.
Which, what happened to your accent, y'all?
My accent?
Yes.
Well, I probably lost that accent when I went away to school, because I was from southern Mississippi and I went to the University of Notre Dame. And I enrolled at Notre Dame the same day that James Meredith enrolled at Ole Miss. And so that was the hot topic about, oh, you're from Mississippi. Well, yeah. But I don't know anything about that. So you learn to drop your accent pretty quickly, and I don't think I still had it. When I was in Americas and in Savannah. I don't think anybody ever asked me, so I probably didn't still have it. But there were people there who knew who I was. In Americas, Red Hefner was there from the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department for much of the time. And Red had been an insurance agent in Macomb, and my family had known him for many years. So he knew who I was when I was there. And... of course, Hosea knew who I was when I was there. And not a lot of other people did, because basically people said, don't say that. It'll just make anybody that you're around a target. And, you know, I was still a stupid kid. Didn't know any better. And some of you have heard this story before, if I've been in touch with you. But I was in a demonstration on the 31st of July at the Colonial Market. That's the shop in that they had. And then we went over to the Quick Check to do the same thing, got locked out, and a group of white folks came around, started beating on the black guys. And I was the stupid kid that went over to the Georgia patrolman watching this and said, aren't you going to do anything about this? And he did. He clonked me over the head with his billy club. And that was my last day in America. So they pulled me back from there pretty quick, but because of this issue. So I think my father didn't speak to me for years for having gone and then being on the front page of the New York Times the next day. You know, and he had to find out from a former principal at my high school at home, who was now in New York, and called him and said, did you know Boyd was in the hospital in Atlanta? Because he was, Dad didn't even know I was in America. So, you know,
well, all our parents were pretty concerned.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And you know, like in my case, the parents were not unsympathetic with what we were doing, but they just thought this is a scary way to go about it. And in fact, my mother told one of my wives later, she never told me directly, but she's never been able to sleep since, she said, because of that summer, always worrying about what was happening to me. And so, because she was explaining, I guess she was explaining to my wife why she had such irregular sleeping patterns, and always up in the middle of the night reading and stuff.
It ended up that I left home around this year.
I'm Elizabeth from, now from Nashville, Tennessee, but I worked in Peach County, Georgia in 1965. So I grew up working class in Duluth, Minnesota, and my dad had his opinions because he was in World War II and had worked in Africa. And they were very racist. He was like Archie Bunker in a lot of ways. And so I was at the University of Minnesota, and Duluth, when I went to Peach County, Fort Valley, it was an intentional decision. I was in my junior year of college, going to be a speech therapist, and they thought I was, my whole life was going down the tubes. They didn't understand at all why I was doing this. And it ended up that we had a big fight about race, because my dad's, because I had made a friend of a folk singer who was African American, and he had come to Duluth. He's just a friend. And I invited him over, and my dad said he would never have that aunt in the house. And I said, that's it. And we had a huge fight. And that was it, and I moved out. So we never did come together about race, you know, about the understanding about it. And my mom, she just didn't want to have waves. But they just, it changed my view of my town, my minister, my church, my friends. I was in a sorority, and they made fun of me. They said, like, your boots are made for walking. And it was just, then it was the Vietnam War, and then I graduated from speech therapy, and I went to Chicago and worked with Dr. King in the whole thing and organizing in Chicago, and got more, I would say, radicalized, because I was a community organizer in uptown Chicago. So it just changed the whole thing, and my household and my sisters, they didn't understand, and it was a very conventional community. So I never resolved that with my parents. I just went on and led my life. But my children are very open and adapt, and are open to all different cultures and races. So that's, you know, that's my little story about what happened with my family.
I'm Richard Reichbart. I'm also part of the Peach County Fort Valley Group from the University of Minnesota. I wasn't here for the morning, so I thought I'd introduce myself. my experiences were very different because I came from a New York City liberal Jewish background. I'd already gotten myself into a lot of trouble before I ended up in Fort Valley, because I had been arrested in the free speech movement in Berkeley, which was in 1964. I kind of changed, and from there, I dropped out because I'd been arrested, and I dropped out of school because my grades were terrible, and then the draft was after me. So I had to get back into school very quickly. The first place that accepted me was the University of Minnesota. I get to the University of Minnesota, and they were organizing students to come down to Fort Valley. But I should say I've gone on to do. I went to law school after that summer. I've worked for Mayor Lindsay in terms of the black community in Coney Island, New York, helping him at one point. And then after law school, the draft was still after me. So I got an occupational draft deferment for working as an OEO legal services attorney for the Navajo and Hopi Indians in Arizona. And then I really dropped out. I drove a cab. I didn't want to become a lawyer anymore. I represented some Indians in Denver. And to make a long story short, I'm now a psychologist and a psychoanalyst back east, which I swore I would never be. I'm a psychoanalyst, and I'm trying to make my profession more understanding of diversity. So we just put out a video, which you can call Black Psychoanalysts Speak. We've had a number of conferences. So that's continued the same thing. So I'm constantly talking about diversity in my institute, and which is not necessarily well-received, even by all the liberals there. But for me, the experience, I don't remember a lot of the details. What I remember is, more than anything else, is the experience of being in the black community.
Yes.
To me, that's what changed it. The churches, the singing, just the people. Mm-hmm. And that's what, and just the experience. So it's helped me in my work as a therapist. It helped me. It was just I can't begin to tell. I also ended up in America.
Yes, I remember. Right, yeah.
But it was just being on quote unquote the wrong side of the tracks, mm-hmm. feeling safe there. I would go back to New York City, and I couldn't stand where I lived, which was at that point because the Upper East Side of New York. If you know the Upper East Side of New York. It's not even the West Side. And I would literally walk by church. I just wanted to be in that community because it's just a wonderful experience. That's what transformed me and continues to transform me. So, I mean.
I'm West Side.
You're West Side.
So where are you now?
Now I'm in a small suburban town. About 20 minutes outside of New York City, but I'm head of a psychoanalytic institute in New York City. And I've been 25 years I've been treating children and adolescents and adults in this town.
Can I introduce somebody who just came in? We also have now with us Betty Jo Harris, who was a local student in Crawfordville, Georgia at the time of the events that happened there. Her father was one of the leaders in the community, and she's joined us, and she probably has some interesting things to say, because what we're discussing is how our parents reacted to our involvement in the movement, and the way your parents reacted was so much different from mm-hmm. the way that our parents reacted mm-hmm. that, you know, that it was fascinating to, you know, to, but we're glad that you're here. You want to do
yes,
that?
I would like to say something about that. I mentioned this morning in the discussion that well, my parents were fired from their jobs, and two teachers who lived, they had a trailer on our property, were also fired, as well as a couple of other people. And when the movement started, I asked my parents if I could participate. I begged, in fact, and I thought they were going to tell me no. And I think they had a conference and decided, well, she should do it. And I think they probably thought that other people's children are out there for the cause. You're our daughter. We're really enmeshed in this process. You should be there too. And I think they thought it would be a good educational experience for me in coming to grips with racial segregation. And I will say that for the most part, it was quiet. It was a segregated society, but it was a polite and quiet one. You know, all hell broke loose when the movement started. And, you know, I certainly saw people differently. But that education represented a transformation for me. And this is my husband with me.
Whoever's next.
What's your name?
Ed Sankowski.
Hi, Ed.
Just call me Mr. Betty Harris.
Mr. Ed.
Someone else want to take up this topic?
Well, the whole idea, I'm just Kenlong talking, the whole idea of being exposed to black people was certainly more than I had experienced. I experienced no relationships with black people until I got to college. Then I had some very positive ones, but it was still pretty rare. And I had never been in the situation that black people frequently found themselves in, where they were the only person of color in a room full of white people. Suddenly, we were the only white person in a room full of black people very frequently, and that was a whole different thing. Joel Siegel, who's passed now, but remarked on it I remember him saying, you know, when I walked down the street, I said, well, there's a Negro, and there's a Negro. Oh, well, there's Joe. You know, when you get to know them, you no longer thought of them as Negro. They just became a person with a name. And so that was a whole different mindset. When I went back to California after that summer, I started to get back into that whole thing. It's us and them. But when you're out there, this was at least an experience where I was one of them. You know, I just felt like a member of the community. And I had to look down, oh, yeah, I'm white, aren't I? It was liberating for us, I think, to go through that. That's all I got.
Shelby Jacobs, I guess I'm rather unique in this group. I was one of two aerospace engineers at the age of about 30 that joined college students. I didn't have a parental left. I was married. I didn't leave and my parents, whatever, so I was making my own decisions. And through Gwen Green and Norm Hodges, I decided in the midst of a concentrated effort to follow up on the commitment made by Kennedy to get to the moon in the Cold War, many of our people were working extended weeks, overtime and so forth, and we had to plead with our corporation, with Rockwell International, to allow us 2 weeks off to come here. So I had a brief stay as a mature adult, and I had, having been born and raised.
Where did you stay?
Where did I stay?
In Macon.
I stayed in Macon. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
My background was born in Dallas, Texas, and my parents migrated to California at age 7, so I had fully integrated into society and forgotten that there was still this gross segregation going on, even though we had some. So it was a cultural shock for me to come here. And I was thinking what part of what I got out of this group that I learned and carried to my entire career was to take advantage of the fact that I had, sufficiently integrated into society that I no longer had an identity except to look down at my skin. Everybody I talked to for years in my work, and one of the people I talked to for like 30 years came to California from Florida, and one of the biggest surprises he had of the whole week of intense technical was that Shelby was black. He had never ever thought one way or the other. But when he saw me, it was a very pleasant surprise. He was a Florida native. He took it in stride, but it was a total surprise. So what I learned here was to take advantage of that fact, that rather than allow people to go through and change their minds about their preconceptions or their prejudices, I always communicated in writing or verbally, and they bought in, And when they saw me, they did their own adjustment. I never got involved with anybody.
That's right. Too late to back out.
Too late to back out. That's what. So that was one of the things I took from here. I've been involved with young student athletes and whatever, and I advise them, be bicultural, and by all means, do everything you can to avoid people who even think they're not prejudiced. If you don't sound like it, they buy in. So take advantage of that. And so that's one of the things that allowed me to matriculate from the back of the bus to the front of the bus in my career, my 40-year aerospace career. I'm 20 years retired.
Whoa.
I'm 80 years old.
You're 80?
Yes.
Oh, no.
He's almost 81.
Oh, my God.
I'll share this around with you. This is an article that was taken out of the newspaper, circulated my from 80
That's
birthday.
How they found you, is through that
That's
newspaper.
How they found me, through an article written in San Diego.
Local paper. The San Diego paper.
Actually,
the reason that was taken, I met a young man out front who I didn't know, who begged me to do him a favor. And I said, oh, okay. I came out of the session. He wanted me to sign a half to 10 of those. And he left. He had one
for
extra.
Motivational back home. He was from
so
home.
What I got out of this my personal time there, which was only 2 weeks, the week of orientation and 1 week in Macon, was a commitment that I made to affirmative action. I'd worked with my company in that, as well as to be sure that I took every advantage of disarming people who innocently did not believe they were prejudiced. Mm-hmm. I did that all my career, and so I owe that to Macon. And from our session this morning, what I learned is your experiences here, from your background, where you came from your families, how naive you could be even though you were young, in terms of what racism is really about. The difference in treatment. Everybody was jailed together and the blacks and whites were treated differently, right in your face. That, to me, was something I appreciated, knowing that there are a group of people who have real-time experiences, who really understand because they were there. Many people who look at this, read the newspaper, they don't really understand. That's part of the struggle we're having right now. If they had walked in your shoes for a couple of weeks or a month or two, we'd be in a different place than we are right today. Thank you.
80 years old.
By the way, I bought a stack of for anybody else that doesn't have my card, I have a couple of cards here for you.
If you Google his name, you can kind of get some really interesting information.
I think that last point is so, I mean, yeah, is so cool. Right.
Which was that?
The last point you made.
Okay. Yes. And there are two. And what I found in doing that was that a lot of people that I know, they suffered with this problem, and people were very innocent. I'm not. I talked to somebody just yesterday who said, I'm colorblind. I don't see color. I said, wait a minute. Please tell me that you see color and it doesn't make a difference. I said, you're passing on. He was. I guess a liberal person, but he was trying to convince people that you don't see color is the answer to the problem. You cannot convince people that you're colorblind. Let them know that color is not the primary criteria for your judgment. And that's okay. I don't have a problem if you see that I'm black. Judge me on whether I'm good, bad, or indifferent, not the color. So I've had a number of conversations with my counterparts during industry who tried to convince me they were colorblind. I said, please, that's an error, tactical error. These young people are not willing to believe you're colorblind. So tell them you see color, but it doesn't make the ultimate difference.
Right.
At least, at best, I allow color to be a tiebreaker. If everything I assess about you is even, then I'll say, okay, color, what color are you? And I'll look down and say, oh, you're okay, you win. So this has been a marvelous experience for me. Like I say, 50 years, I just can't believe how fast the 50 years has gone and how well it served me.
How did you all, I mean, I'm a new spectator, but how did you all just keep this? I mean, here you are 50 years later, you're still as adamant and passionate about it as you were when you were 19. How did you just keep that without being influenced by others?
I think because it changes your perspective after you are part of something. Now, as someone else said, you're sort of oblivious. And back in the 50s and 60s, people were polite. I was in San Diego. It was segregated, but politely segregated. And the school I went to was in a fairly well-to-do area, but we had people of color and some Mexicans also, because of they took in Navy housing and the gerrymandering, they couldn't get rid of the U.S. Navy. So they had to take some of the students. So we all worked together, some of our cheerleaders. I remember it was an African-American woman I was friendly with, a girlfriend. She was we were in the All-City Orchestra together, and I remember asking my mother, Margaret needs a ride to orchestra practice. I didn't mention that she was black. And my mother never mentioned it, just gave her a ride. And so we were friendly, but we didn't really hang out together. Thing is, we kept in contact over the years. And after, you know, my experience in Macon and going on living in New York City, we're now pretty good friends. And I've sat down and asked her experiences and her viewpoint of that time, which had to be different than mine, because I was oblivious. I thought everything was just fine, you know, at that point in time. So we become good friends. I stay with her when I go out to California, and she stays with me in New York. And so you learn. We've kept that friendship over the 50-plus years, because this goes back to junior high and high school. And as a footnote, she was Suge in Color Purple, Margaret Avery.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah. And so after she left San Diego, she said she was even in for a culture shock, because she was protected in our school. It was very polite. And when she got out in more of the real world, up in the Hollywood and L.A., she even came in for some shock. And so it was very, it's quite interesting to talk to her.
You know, that reminds me of experience I had along that line, where I was, my high school people voted me the most likely to succeed, and they later learned how naive they were.
Yeah.
When my high school principal learned from as a result of an aptitude test that I've scored high in math and science, and engineering was one of the careers, he recommended I should take a trade because there were no black engineers. And yet I had people who voted me the most likely to succeed. They had no clue what the barriers were.
There was only 5 blacks in the whole.
The number of blacks was less than 1%. And I was voted class president, and I had a half hour interview at the town where I grew up. And the interviewer asked me, Shelby, what was it like? And I said, I was always one in a few. My entire life, my entire career was that way, including coming here. We were 2 blacks in a group with white kids from all over the country. Mm-hmm. We happened to be tied with UCLA kids, but I said that was not a problem for me. And so I often talk to people about assimilating, is the word I was trying to use a while ago, to create an air of comfort within you wherever you are, and people will accept you. If you are ill at ease and people don't know how to help you with that, it's going to create a little bit of distance. They're going to leave you alone. So I think that part of what I learned here is to, if you bring a smile and good feelings to a situation, it tends to propagate throughout. If you're negative and down and uncertain, then people tend to be a little apprehensive about you. So it allowed me to reinforce the importance of having a positive self-image. No matter how big or small you are, my motto was just do the best you can until you can do better.
Back in high school, they had an acting club, which I was not in. I have no talent in that line, but Margaret Avery, of course, was in it, and she told me what she remembers most. It came out of some of high school reunions. Of course, I always gave her the part of the maid. But she remembers some of her friends in class, some of the white students, kept trying to convince the teacher and they wanted to trade parts with her, because they kept saying she's the better actress and give her the lead and I'll be the maid.
Yes.
And of course the teacher wouldn't allow it, but she she's still in touch with those people through the reunion. I mean, these girls come back, and so that was one of her remembrances, because just sort of institutionalized thinking.
So the subtle racism that she was imposed on her, you would not expect that would happen.
And also, but the kids didn't take it.
Yes.
Or tried not to.
Right. I remember for me, this is Neil Reichlein, the aftermath of the Civil Rights Movement was the Vietnam era, Vietnam War era. And the energy and the consciousness I got from being a civil rights worker during that era continued for me for many years. And I was involved in the draft resistance movement. And my friends didn't evade the draft or run away from the draft. They took it on with their lives and their bodies, and most of them went to jail for doing that. And, you know, I was a CO during that era, and I remember I was totally surprised getting a CO. My intention was to resist the draft, and I applied for a CO to, when I went to court, I would have something to show them. But I was editor of the paper at UCLA, and I got 3 campus ministers to write letters for me, and my dad was a shrink psychoanalyst for the VA. And he got the head of the VA to write me a letter, and so not only did I get it, I never even had to go in front of the draft board, and I got the CO. And it kind of pissed me off. This wasn't my plan. So I went to my dad and I said to him, you're going to get letters ordering me to do alternative service or something. And I says, I'm not reading these letters. You can open them, you can throw them away, you can do whatever you want, but I am not going to read these letters. And I went on with my life, fighting against the war and being the editor of the newspaper and making documentaries about draft resistance, etc. And 5 years later, my dad explained to me what happened. I indeed got ordered to do alternative service. I didn't respond, and I got a note saying I was going to be arrested and I was going to have to face trial. And my dad, the wonderful shrink that he was and loving person, I went to a lawyer, Bill Smith in L.A., who was working with people to get out of the draft. And they discovered I was drafted out of turn, and they got me out. And he didn't tell me that till 5 years later. And I hugged him, I broke down in tears, I thanked him, because going to jail wasn't the idea. The idea was to stop the draft and put your body on the line as much as you could. But all that energy from the civil rights movement, which I think was the point of highest consciousness of this nation in my lifetime, kept me going for a long time in terms of making decisions about what I did as a career, what I made movies about, what actions I took during the draft, and later on how I raised my kids and how I just did things in the world.
That was my next question to you. Did this passion you have go on to your kids, your grandkids and so on?
Yeah, my kids are pretty cool.
Do they all feel like you do?
Yeah.
Well, okay.
They do.
Very often where it stops.
They have good heads. It's probably my wife, my late wife, that did all that, but nonetheless.
They did.
Yeah, and so I just feel like it was, you know, it was this, for me, a major starting point for the rest of my life. And I've tried to follow the tenets and things I learned then. I want to tell you one more thing, two more things. Going door to door and working about registering voters is quite something. And I made a film. We tried to stop the USS Constellation from going back from San Diego, going back to Vietnam. And we held a vote. And we got 22,000 mostly Navy personnel to vote to keep that carrier in San Diego. Of course, it went. And dropped more tons of bombs on Vietnam than all the bombs dropped in World War II. But I was totally at ease going up to sailors and talking about keeping the Connie home, you know, because that was nothing compared to going door to door and make it. My wife passed away after I was with her since 11th grade in high school, 42 years. And I drove off into the Southwest. I just had needed a, you know, I went to Monument Valley and screamed and cried and hung out with myself for a while. And it was during the Kerry campaign. And I thought, well, I'll volunteer in the campaign. I'll surround myself with young people. And I'll revive myself and get back to life. And so they assigned me to Sun City, where I was the young person. And it did the same thing, though. But going door to door in a place like Arizona, where you're not likely to meet friendly people going door to door, again, was nothing because of the experience I had working in the South. And I just felt fearless doing it. And so I've carried this experience with me a long time.
I worked as a newspaper reporter for a couple of years, and I remember there was a black minister that would come to city council meetings that I would be covering, and sometimes we struck up a conversation, and after about 6 months we were starting to talk to each other one day, and I said, well, you know, I was a civil rights worker. He says, I thought there was something different about the way you just were so approachable, and you know, stuff that you didn't have that little barrier people sometimes had.
Would you say your name, Ken?
Ken Long was speaking there.
How about over there? Shelby Jacobs again. I was reflecting on the war era. I was old enough to be employed by Rockwell and Aerospace, part of the Cold War. So I always had my feelings about those protesters of the war, and I still have major problems with the military-industrial complex and why we have to have wars, because we can't stockpile, we gotta use this stuff as part of what goes on. So I have most of my friends, even today, we live near Camp Pendleton in Oceanside, California. They invariably, when they find out I'm as old as I am, they say, well, what military? What you got? I said, I'm a 40-year veteran of the Cold War. And I'm one of those who fought not to fight. That was my whole aim in life, is we've got to find a way to interact with people without fighting. Discussions, whether it be an argument, whatever, shouldn't end up with somebody committing the ultimate. So I've always been passive in that regard. Last resort, I would only do physical harm to anybody in the case of absolute last resort, can't do anything else kind of thing. So I could identify with a lot of people from civil rights to pacifists to during that era while I was involved in Kennedy's promise to beat the Russians to the moon. And when that was over, we went on to do other things. And I always had a fond association. And one of the ties I spoke of earlier this morning, in 1965, I've completed the requirements in my career for a separation system, which you see the photos on those cards, the separation of Apollo 6, which flew on the day Martin Luther King was assassinated, April the 4th, 1968. Now get that. It flew on the day he was assassinated. I completed the requirements the year I was here. That combined with the other things that I got from you, and now that I backfill what your experiences were, underscores how profound you are to me in my life.
By the way, his last name is Jacobs. And when we got married, people said, oh, you married a Jewish guy.
And you said, yes.
That's appropriate.
I'm like Sammy Davis. I said, no, I don't want, I'm already black. Why would I do that?
I wanted to say something related to Richard Reichbart. I'm not a religious person, but there was something about this experience. And I don't particularly like the word spiritual, but there was something about it, and particularly because I spoke in the black churches in black church a number of times in Fort Valley. There was something about that experience, the only which to me, and the experience of singing "We Shall Overcome," that was so moving, right, that I will never forget. And the only thing I frankly find equal to it, it's not really part of this discussion, was the experience of being the only white guy at a Navajo ceremony in the middle of not too far from Monument Valley with in that culture, and their healing, one of their healing ceremonies with people around. But there was something so different than frankly my own culture because I've never had that feeling with my own culture in terms of its particular way of celebrating spiritual things, because it's so, how do I say it? It's so rule-bound. Yeah. I don't know what, any other way to say it. That, to me, was transformative. And there were also individual things that just stand out in my mind. I felt very close to Ben Clark. You knew Ben Clark.
I knew Ben very well, yes.
And there was something about that that just... Yeah. And there's, I have to tell this one experience, which... We were in Americus. I was only in Americus briefly. But there was a mimeographing some flyer or something. And Ben was there, and it was, of course, it was at a mortuary, because
Barnum's funeral.
Barnum's, because that was the only safe place, you know, because the mortician wasn't beholden at all to white folks.
We had that discussion earlier about that.
But anyhow, so we're turning out. You remember the old mimeograph things?
Oh yes.
And it was hot, so literally the guys had their shirts off and all, and Ben Clark. And Ben Clark was a little guy with a booming voice, came from Savannah, left Savannah to be, and was one of the first people arrested in Savannah in one of the lunch counter. And he's a little guy with this booming voice, and he was magical when he spoke. He really was. He could organize anybody. So Ben's there turning things out, and his hands get all black, and all of us, and all the guys have their shirts off. And he looks at me, and he comes up to me, and I knew what he was going to do. His hands are all black, and I don't have my shirt. He places his hands right on my chest, and then he says, sorry, he says, now you're black like me. That will live with me forever.
And it was Vinny, yeah. I mean, Vin would say those things all the time. I mean, it really was so typical when you told me that story. I could picture that, although I was gone by then. But
I had some of the, not the same, but I think what I started with Elizabeth Jesse was in Port Valley. Some of the experiences I had, I said earlier, were more internal, and I had never been or understood anthropology, but I guess it's sort of like when you are participating with a different culture, everything becomes like this big, you know, it's like Minnesota was like this big, all of a sudden the world was this big. And so experiencing living with Edna Rump, who was a janitress at Fort Valley College, and she was raising these four kids, and they would go out and pick peaches in the morning. And they'd wear long shirts and gloves because the insecticide. So at the end of the day, they would come home with a bandana full of nickels. Not really full, but a bandana with nickels. And they had worked like probably 8-10 hours a day. And there was no indoor toilet, so I mean, that's an experience. If you have to go outside and there's an outhouse and the roaches are like, felt like they were mice, you know, it's like scary as hell, you know. And then the person that I stayed with, in the Ms. Rump was brave to have us stay, and we shared, Nancy and I, Nancy Addison, and I shared a bed together. And she was afraid the Klan was going to get her if she went out to use the outhouse. So Mrs. Rump gave us a pea pot, you know, that we had in the room. And so, you know, just learning. And Ms. Rump fixed hair right next to the house. So I told the story earlier that I wanted her to fix my hair to make it straight because it was real curly. And it basically kind of got fried. But the guys in the community thought it was just the funniest thing, and they thought it was pretty cool. It was all greased down. But we did stuff together, and so we got to know each other. Like, we're going to go see Willie Sneed tomorrow. I called him, and he's the local organizer for Fort Valley. And Willie was so funny to talk to on the way down here, because Willie taught these white kids how to sing, and how to sing and clap at the same time, and how to sing and clap and feel it in your body
in this room that
especially
was...
Especially for somebody from Minnesota.
Yeah. But it was like a room with a light bulb hanging down. It felt like an interrogation. It was just a little shack. I don't know the name of it or what the shack was. But he would have us singing, and he also kind of like helped us figure out where to go, the lay of the land. Like, they made...
School buses,
Peach County, and they made Bluebird school buses.
Bluebird Body Company.
And so I remember, you know, you go by the peach, the thing that processed the peaches, and the guy would say, "You black whore, you black nigger lover," and, you know, people would, you know, holler at you. But we went to the fairgrounds with a group of people from Fort Valley. Well, these group of white guys started following us, but that's where my naivete was. I didn't realize we could have actually been harmed. And we just carried on. We integrated the movie theater. We went up into the balcony. People followed us with their cars. And anywhere we went, there was always someone really watching us. But to me, it was more of learning about how cultures work and the oppression of the African-American people in the community. Like, we tried to get street lights and the roads paved because it was dirt roads, no street lights, and people registered to vote. I was staying in Ms. Rump's house, and a white insurance agent came to the door. Oh my God, he was totally shocked that I, you know, answered the door. So it was events like that. Like, one of the children had sickle cell anemia. There were four children Ms. Rump raised, and she's real, real thin. And I went to Fort Valley, you know, a college, to the pool. Well, she got too cold, and she had sickle cell crisis. So we had to take her to the doctor. Well, we couldn't find a doctor that would take her, and that was a black-only clinic that would see her. So that's the kind of learning that took place. It wasn't like book learning. It was like actually learning about how people live. And one of the other things is, are you always, when I hear Sugar Pie Honey, you know that song? Sugar Pie Honey, love you. Well, we were all jammed into this car together, the black kids we worked with and us, and we were singing that song to the top of our lungs. You know, and the guy next to me, his dad worked, he was head of the funeral parlor, and this kid had brain damage from being in an accident. I just remember him singing, and then we all went to, there was a barn where we went up and partied, and there was corn liquor. So Willie had a gallon of corn liquor, which he shared with all of us, right? And I had never really drunk much in Minnesota. But that corn liquor is strong, that green alcohol. I tell you what. I mean, I told Willie that yesterday, and he says, yeah, it was $5 a gallon or something then, and now it's like 50. But it was the singing, the humor, the spirituality, the interchange, all of that was as important to me as the work that we did, you know, registering people to vote, trying to get the street, you know, petitions, trying to help people read. So I came away with far more than any of us could have ever given to that community. I mean, it changed my life. So anyway, that's a long story short.
Shelby, you told me the story by email, just talking about culture shock and things. The story about the ice cream incident?
Yes.
Why don't you share that with some of the people that had... This occurred in Macon shortly after he got there.
The ice cream incident, as I recall, we... with a group of us, we were in need of some refreshment for the evening, and so we said, well, why don't we get about a gallon of ice cream and take it back so we can all... And so we said, while we were there, we saw all these different flavors there that you wouldn't believe. They must have had 15 flavors. So we all picked one, and we began to share in our naivete from California. We, rather than try to explain to you what this particular flavor is like, we exchanged licks on ice cream cones around very innocently. The clerk behind the counter
I could just visualize she was going through some just gyrations, like as we just disrupted her entire life. Her grandfather was rolling over in his graves. She had read about this going on, and now she's seen it. It's indelibly etched in her mind. She could not ever get out of her mind. She saw this exchange. So we went back and had a security meeting. Said, do you realize what we're doing to these people? It's quite normal to us. Just to, how long would it take me to explain to you what black walnut ice cream with a dash of pistachio in it compared to just let you look at. Now we can compare notes. So at 30 years old, I was still naive, having assimilated in California. Mm-hmm. I was naive to the impact it had on people there. Mm-hmm. And so what I came away with is one of the things that all of you, as you took your risks of what you were doing, you had to be careful that you didn't inflame the situation beyond the norm by our social behavior, which was certainly not the norm for them. And so I always cherished that. When I came back to California, I talked to people about how culturally shocked I was, even though I thought I was progressive and aware of the whole nation as we were progressing along, as I was getting in engineering and I was being allowed to do things that blacks had never done before. Well, I couldn't conceive that Georgia was that far behind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that happened while we were there, I heard somebody talking about outsiders coming in, not only the civil rights, they were talking about how we were upsetting the economy. Forget the name of the town. There was an air base nearby.
Warner Robins.
I heard somebody discussing the fact that people from the west and the north were coming, and they were paying people $1 an hour, and that was totally upsetting the economy. $1 an hour, that was like $40 a week. They were making like $20 for a 5.5 or 6 day week. That's how innocently we were. We were innocently paying $1 an hour, and they were livid about that. So in every respect that I found that as we left and went back to California, and you were going to be there the rest of the summer, I felt you were all exposed to the inadvertent impact of the community by your not understanding their culture to the degree now you were exposed to. And the risk was not just going to jail, it was life. Lehman property, and it was very dangerous. So I respected that from people that I knew. And another thing, I just heard somebody talk about outhouse. I had an interview, it's on Living Legacy at Santa Clarita, where I grew up, half-hour interview, where they talked to me about my space program, and this comes up. And I mentioned somehow in my write-up that I shared with him that I had an outhouse in California. People couldn't conceive that I would be aware of what an outhouse was. They thought that was something that happened in the 18th to 19th century or in the Ozarks or whatever. Well, I had an outhouse.
When you were growing up?
When I was growing up. My father built the house. Well, on two occasions, I remember. Before I left Texas, we moved into a section of town where they built new homes for blacks in 1941. Would you believe that? Brand new homes. Historically, we've always had hand-me-downs, but my father and a few people I know moved into a new black community. One of the things they didn't have was bathrooms inside. So I was telling the story about my having a bathroom in the backyard. It wasn't too far from the pump in the yard, which we pumped water right out of the ground. And my brother, there comes a time with those, you have to move them because they get full. And my dad moved the outhouse. And the outhouse that we had prior, he let it go too far. It was only about 6 inches of dirt over it. My brother fell in that. So I was telling this story about that I was aware of outhouses. Here I am in California now. It's 2005, about 10 years ago. And so when we moved to California, my dad built the house. While we were building the house, he erected a structure with tent siding, so we didn't have to pay rent while we built. We had an outhouse again, except it was a grandiose two-holer.
Oh wow!
I mean, you didn't have to wait and learn. You could.
I grew up East Tennessee. And
co-educational two-holer
bathroom.
So the outhouse was part of my experience too, so I can relate to that.
I I just your comments about the music in the car.
Yes.
I
your name?
Neil Reichlein. I've always been a pretty good dancer. And I remember nights going up the street. There were two young girls in the house. And we would occasionally go up there and listen to music and dance. And I remember they taught me how to do the locomotion. And is that the song with Shotgun? Or something? Whatever song that is.
Oh, the Journey.
Perhaps, but... I was doing my best. I thought I was doing great, and everybody was laughing at me.
Yeah.
Speaking of this, Shelby Jacobs again. Speaking of dancing, I was the son of a
preacher man.
Holy roller preacher man. We weren't allowed to do that, but I learned later in life to do that. And one of the things I take great pride in, because I was a part of the space program. I learned to do and still do the moonwalk.
Demonstration. Yeah, I just have to say from what Neil said that, you know, white men can't dance. And I didn't learn that effectively until after the summer when I had gone to Hopewell, Virginia to... I had gone to Hopewell, Virginia to help in a...
That's the 80-year-old version. 10 or 20 years ago, I did it better.
You can do it better without different shoes and different...
Just come and see you off.
Yeah, but if there's no carpet,
I can't go get my dance shoes. Yeah.
When I was at the end of the summer, when I was helping with a campaign in Hopewell, Virginia, Hopewell is right down the road from Petersburg, where Virginia State College is, and Virginia State University. And it was the same experience. We went to a mixer one night. The twist was the big thing then, you know. And I just thought I was really hot stuff out on the floor doing the twist, and everybody in the place was falling over, screaming. Laughing at how ridiculous I looked doing this. So I know exactly what you mean, Neil.
On the theme of dance, I do a lot of dancing in New York City, swing dancing. I used to go to the Frankie Manning party. He died a week before his 100th birthday. He was out of Harlem in the 30s and quite well known and did a lot of movies. The Nicholas Brothers were at some of these parties, and I got on to ballroom dancing, a lot of things. But I was dancing with one person I knew, an African-American man, and he couldn't keep time with the music, and I said, "You are just ruining the stereotype." I said, I am just crushed.
Because you got rhythm.
No, I can dance. And I used to, 10 years ago, I gave up the flips on someone's shoulder and all that. But I thought... one comment on voter registration going door to door. Sometime during the early part of the summer, maybe it was one of the leaders in Macon asked us to find someone to try to pass the literacy exam. We had gotten a copy of the questions. So I had found someone, and of course we took someone about a day to research the answers because they were quite difficult. And I sat with this woman in her home, actually in her bedroom. She wasn't feeling well, coaching her on the answers. And they were complicated answers. It wasn't an easy memorization. And I eventually took her to the courthouse and passed it, and I must say they were not happy. So it was, but it was very interesting. This is Beth Pickham.
Beth, I think I remember this, that one of the registrars came out to check one of the answers with us.
Could be.
Because we knew, but they didn't even know.
No one could pass this. I remember there were 10 questions. The first two anyone could answer. Who is the President of the United States and who is the Vice President? Then it went into things like, well, the Georgia amended the second article of the Georgia Constitution in 1952, saying, and you're going, huh?
Yeah, it was the third pronoun in the fourth line.
Yeah,
of this,
I mean, it was like bizarre. So, but this woman did very well. It was before the Rights Act had passed that summer, so she had passed the literacy. And they were not too happy.
You don't happen to still have a copy of that?
No, document. But who was with us this morning? Who has a copy from another? It wasn't Macon, but it must be similar.
Yeah.
I want to
Joe,
see that.
Joe is Albany. Looking for a copy of the Georgia State Literacy.
This is the 20-some question one.
Yeah,
I'd like to see it.
She would like to have that just for the record for all
she knows,
of those.
She knows where it is.
Does she know where it is now?
Because I'm sure they're all similar.
I promised her where it is.
Okay, good.
Someone posted it on Facebook.
Because it's all it's so obscure. It's got to be there somewhere. It must be somewhere in the court documents too, as you said. No one could answer. The judge couldn't answer these questions.
It is after four as well.
Shelby again. The lady here mentioned the reaction she got when she was in a black household. People come to the door and see you're black and white in a black household. Well, I still get that in my neighborhood.
Yeah, really?
I retired 20 years ago, and people still come by and are surprised of who's the owner. I have a Spanish guy who's my age, a little older, who gets very irritated. The stereotypical thing when you live in it, and I'll show you that you can pass that around. Live in the neighborhood, people think that there wouldn't be a black living there. So when you come to the door, you've got to be a servant or something. And about 7 or 8 years ago, a group of people came, and they had to sit down and talk. They were so blown away that we lived there. That's punctuated the last 20 years of my life in particular. One of the incidents that occurred in that along the lines of that, I had some furniture delivered. Did you get to see this? Furniture delivered when we first purchased the house. I went through layout on computer and various things of how we wanted. Brought in furniture. So my furniture was delivered by a company from Los Angeles, from the Orange County area. And it was a black crew. They came to the door. They did the same thing. So I discussed it with them. They've delivered furniture in the suburbs for years. The number of times they encountered a black there was close to zero. So here they were. They were surprised. So I said, there's a phenomenon, the stereotypical thing. And I've been one in the neighborhood who I'm out and about. People get to know me because I'm out in the house, out in the yard or whatever. So what I see is some of those stereotypical things, like you were talking about, where the roads are paved and where it's not. My neighborhood, you look at that, you don't see anybody, it's quiet. You would think there's no way any person of color could live there. Well, it's mixed. It's really integrated.
Yeah.
And people still to this day adhere to the old guidelines. You can't possibly live here.
So Shelby, I just want to give you the answer. You reminded me of something. Does anybody know who Carl Rowan is? Mm-hmm. He used to write for the Washington Post.
Sure.
So Carl Rowan was mowing his lawn one day, and he lived west of the park in D.C., Rock Creek, which is the Gold Coast, right? And somebody stopped when they saw him mowing his lawn and asked him how much he charged for that. And he said, I sleep with the lady of the house.
That's pretty high.
Folks, I've got to return this now to Bruce, but we can keep talking if we want to.
I just want to say one more thing.
Naturally.
I know a lot of you guys have returned to where you were working, but if you haven't, you should. I went 3 years ago, I did a trip around the country and stopped in Macon. I didn't know the street, I didn't know the address of the house that I stayed in, but I knew the street. And I went to the street, and I slowly drove down the street until I spotted the house. And I broke into tears. I sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. Mm-hmm. Because it was like visiting my 19-year-old self.
Yeah, that's right.
The connection was that strong.
Wow. Mm.
Do it.
Yeah.
I want to do that sometime this week, and I understand it's a conflict on the tours. And I talked to Dr. Davis, who teaches at college there in Macon. I will try to find a way to do it. Anybody else going to Macon this time?
Yeah.
When are you going?
Sunday.
Chuck Hammond has the van.
Yeah, Chuck Hammond's making arrangements.
I understood from that van that they were not returning. They're going to spend the night there.
Hope so. Otherwise, you're stuck in Macon forever.